I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. During the pandemic, essential workers in healthcare, food service, public transit, law enforcement, and other sectors of the hands-on economy had to go to work during the pandemic, whether they wanted to or not. Many others who could work from home were able to use technology to keep in touch with their employees, their managers and coworkers, have meetings and take care of their responsibilities remotely. Now, with millions vaccinated, workplaces are beginning to reopen and call back their remote workers. One critical question: can employers mandate vaccinations as a condition of employment? We asked Robert Field to answer that and other questions about COVID safety and the workplace. He's a professor of health management and policy at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health. He's a lecturer in healthcare management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and senior fellow at Penn's Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. And Robert Field, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Let's get right to it. Can an employer require that returning employees be vaccinated as a condition of being in the building and having a job?
For the most part, the answer is yes. But as with a lot of legal questions, there are a few wrinkles. This is new legal terrain. We've never used a medical product under an emergency use authorization, which is the status of the vaccines, as widely as this before. And the EUA, emergency use authorization, is different from full FDA approval, which we'll probably have in a few months, but we don't have yet. So the wrinkles to consider are: an exception has to be given if the employee has a medical risk, if they're immunocompromised, or there's some other reason they can't take the vaccine. Under most circumstances, an exception has to be given for sincere religious objections. In both of those cases, the employer has to offer an alternative, an accommodation. That could be working remotely, if that's possible, working in a separate area, wearing a mask, frequent testing, if that doesn't impose what's called an undue burden on the employer. In many cases, that would not be possible. If it's a public-facing organization, if it's a specialty store, if it's a gym, something like that. The other legal wrinkle to consider, which is sort of percolating in the back of health lawyers' minds, is mandating the vaccine under an EUA, since that's never been done before.
Go ahead. Finish your sentence. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So there's language in the statute that seems to suggest that it cannot be mandated until there's full FDA approval. But the thinking of among most health lawyers is that private companies can go ahead.
Can employers ask about health status? Or I have one of those CDC cards. I got my vaccination. Can they ask to see that? Can they ask whether I or anyone else has been tested, or whether there's someone who's who's at risk at home with them? Just how many of those more personal questions can an employer ask?
Right. So they can't delve into your medical history, but they can ask if you've been vaccinated and can ask for evidence of that. That's really a behavior more than a medical record. The HIPAA law would not apply because most employers are not healthcare providers, but they could ask about your vaccination status without going beyond that, unless you volunteer the information.
I'm also just sort of curious about if someone just does not, they don't want to get the vaccine because they don't trust it. I mean, we know that there are millions, a good portion of the population, that just doesn't feel comfortable for whatever reason to get the vaccination. Is that a kosher thing to offer at work?
No, there's nothing in the law that protects that. It would have to be a medical risk, particular to the individual, or a sincere religious objection.
And for people who do come to work and who are vaccinated, what rights do they have to feel essentially safe on the job?
Well, they can go under the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act, which guarantees you a safe workplace. And if the lack of vaccine requirements or masking or something similar is creating a risk, they would have a right under that law to go after the employer saying that the work environment is not safe.
If the CDC were to say, and they haven't said this yet, that you can go unmasked at, actually, guys, they have said, this is where it gets confusing because there's so many people telling us what we can and cannot do. But it seems that the CDC is saying to people who are vaccinated that you can go unmasked if you are in a building. Do I have that correct? If you are inside?
Yeah, if you're around, yes, if you're around other vaccinated people. The trick is, how do you establish that the other people have been vaccinated? And you pretty much have to take their word for it.
Right. You have to trust what they say. But could a company have a policy saying, yeah, the CDC says that, but as far as we're concerned, these are going to be our policies?
Well, what the CDC has said is guidance. It's not law. So you can use that as a general standard, as a guidepost, but that's not really the determinative factor. The determinative factor is it a safe and healthy workplace? And is the employee creating a direct threat to other workers or to customers?
What do you feel about, it's called a vaccine passport, it has other names as well. What do you think about that?
I think the word passport is unfortunate. It conjures up the image of the passport that you use to travel across borders, which is an official government document. You can't leave the country without it. There's a database of everyone who has a passport. We're not going in that direction in the United States. We're not going to see a centralized data system with a government-issued ID. It would be logistically impossible and politically very difficult as well. What we may see is verification of your vaccination, and that could be the CDC card, or it could be an app. In the state of New York is developing a voluntary app. CVS is creating an app for people that company has vaccinated. If by passport you mean these voluntary mechanisms, then we're going to see more of it.
Then we're going to see more of that. You had talked about earlier about segregation might be too strong a word, but having people that maybe are unvaccinated could be in one part of a building and the vaccinated people in the other part. Would that be a workable solution to trying to figure out how to get people back to work?
It depends on the work situation. If you're talking about a health club, say, is there a back office where people could work? Probably not. There probably is not an accommodation that could be made. If it's an office where people are at desks behind their computers, then perhaps you could have a separate room for unvaccinated people. This hasn't been tested yet legally, and logistically it might be difficult in a lot of cases. But if you had people who could not be vaccinated for medical or religious reasons, it would be a reasonable accommodation to consider in some cases.
The CDC says as of today, about 50%, about half of adults are vaccinated. So I don't want people to have the impression that, you know, everyone is putting up some kind of resistance to vaccination. There's been a lot millions of Americans who have said, yes, I want to be vaccinated. So I just want to make sure that our listeners know that in many ways, these are problems that have been solved because people are vaccinated.
Yeah. And as we get more and more people vaccinated, it will be less and less of an issue. You'll have fewer people who would be subject to exclusion. And those who were not vaccinated would be less at risk of getting the disease. We're still a ways away from that.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say that there's an ethical issue that will also be mitigated as more people are vaccinated, which is access to the vaccine.
Right.
If you are an employer and you're demanding your workers be vaccinated, what does it mean for the people who couldn't get the vaccine, either because of logistical problems or priority in their states? that would raise a problem, but again, less and less of a problem as vaccine access becomes more and more easy.
I heard that some employers said gave their employees time off to get a vaccination or time off if they didn't feel well after getting a vaccination.
Yeah, so that's the alternative that most employers are using. Rather than the heavy-handed, you have to be vaccinated, encouraging it. Maybe offering them a cash bonus, time off, extra vacation days, flexibility if you do have side effects the next day, making vaccination easier, bringing vaccination into the workplace. That certainly is legally safer. You don't have any of these issues about who can get an exception and what the regulatory status of the vaccine is. So most lawyers would advise their clients do that first if possible.
Right. You mentioned cash bonuses. Is there a limit to that? I mean, $50, $100, $500?
That's up to the employer. I saw that United Airlines is offering free flights or a lottery for free flights for people who've been vaccinated, presumably to get more customers. No, it's within the employer's bank account. If you want to offer people $10,000, you can do it. The people who've already been vaccinated and don't qualify might be a little resentful, but you could certainly offer it.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Isn't that a little unfair if some people get cash and other people just did it because they felt it was the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think it depends on the amount. And one way to mitigate that would be to say the bonus goes to everyone who gets vaccinated or has been vaccinated. But if it's time off to get the vaccine or to recover from side effects, or if it's making it easier to access the vaccine, I don't think that creates an ethical dilemma. And it certainly doesn't create a legal dilemma.
Robert Field, we're almost out of time here, but what has this year been like for you?
Like everyone, I've adjusted to working remotely. Since I teach, I'm eager to get back in the classroom, which I will hopefully be able to do in the fall. And then just every day, I check my emails and see new legal issues arising, issues that we never thought we'd be facing in the immediate future. I've been teaching public health law for many years now, and we talked about quarantines and lockdowns and mandatory vaccination as hypotheticals.
Right.
And it's nice to be able to illustrate it for students, but it's kind of discouraging that we're actually living this stuff today.
Well, I appreciate, as always, having you as a guest on Radio Times, Robert Field. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that was Robert Field, professor of health management and policy at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health. We're going to take a very short break, and then we've got two more guests waiting in the wings. We're talking about this return to work for remote workers, and we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know your experiences. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Fully half of adults are vaccinated against COVID-19. Many workplaces that had sent their employees home during the pandemic are calling them back. For some, now that is welcome news. No more juggling job and home responsibilities from their bedroom and feeling they have lost any semblance of a work-life balance. Others have found that remote work actually works for them. They stay connected, they have more autonomy, have been more productive, and definitely do not miss that daily commute. I must add that millions of Americans could not work remotely because of the nature of their jobs and have been on the front lines, in some cases risking their lives to keep the rest of us safe and fed. They deserve our heartfelt thanks and probably a pay raise. We want to talk about what we have learned about remote work and how to manage this return to the office. And we have two guests who have joined us. Amy Edmondson is Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School. She's got a recent book. It's titled The Fearless Organization, Creating Psychological Safety in the Workplace for Learning, Innovation, and Growth. Amy Edmondson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
And also with us is Constance Hadley. She's an organizational psychologist at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. Constance Hadley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, and we do want to hear from you. We want to know your experience. We want to know whether you want to go back to work, you want to stay working remotely. This is a show for you. So again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Constance, or Connie, let me begin with you. And as Robert Field was saying, we have lived through this sort of weird forced experiment. Many of us, myself included, sent home for our own safety, for the safety of the workplace, frankly, for the safety of our country and our healthcare system. This has been a strange social experiment in remote working. Are there lessons learned from your perspective?
Oh, absolutely. I would never have wanted this to happen to the world, but I think as a social scientist, there's no doubt that this has been a year full of experiments and learning. We have learned quite a lot about what it's like to shift gears quickly in terms of how people work, and I would give us an A+ on that overall. I think people were remarkably able to transform their day-to-day work into whatever configuration they needed to do. And as you mentioned, not everyone could go to working from home or elsewhere. But I also think that some of our early predictions didn't pan out. So I think we've seen quite a seesawing, for example, in terms of how people feel about working from home. At first it was scary, then it became kind of great, and then it became really tedious. And now people are trying to decide, you know, what's going to happen next.
Right, right. And everyone's got a different life and a different job. And I do want to get to that. Amy Edmondson, let me give you a chance to sort of weigh in on this last year that we've been through work-wise. What do you see? Have we learned some good lessons?
I think the number one lesson is we've learned we can change fast when we need to. We can be agile when we need to. Other than that, I think Connie has it just right. We've learned a lot, and I think we've also learned that we miss each other.
Even though we have, and when I say we, I mean the collective we, you know, we talk to each other by Zoom or, you know, every day. Certainly we do have done this on Radio Times. We've stayed connected through a Slack channel. But you're saying, Amy, that doesn't really, is not a substitute for that person-to-person interaction?
It's not a substitute for the real thing. We're not really making eye contact. We're not really sensing and connecting with each other in the same way. That's fine for some things, and it's suboptimal for others.
And from your perspective, Connie, you gave us all an A+, and that's a wonderful thing to have. Something never really happened to me when I was in school.
An easy grader.
But is that because of technology, that technology did actually do its job in terms of connecting us?
Well, I think the A+ is that I would give is really more to what Amy was talking about, is the fact that people were able to pivot and rise to the occasion. And there's nothing like life or death circumstances to motivate people to do that. But just as a small example, I know I was in the middle of my semester at the Questrom School of Business, and I was working with students, you know, in person every week, and I had 4 days to convert everything to remote. And like all of my colleagues around the world in the same situation, we were able to do that and not miss a beat. And so that's really, I think, that what we need to remind ourselves of. We can change because we're about to enter another period of change, the transition to post-pandemic. And so I do, you know, think it's important for us to remember we've already been tested and succeeded in many ways. But like Amy says, I'm very concerned about the connectivity of employees. And in fact, in some of my research, we've seen that people were lonely before the pandemic, and that was increasing. Mark Mortensen and I have a study that showed, in fact, the number of people who were on a number of teams, even though it seems like that would make people feel more connected to others, and actually decrease the level of connectivity they felt. Mm. And so I think that we have to remind ourselves life wasn't that great in some ways before the pandemic as well. So this is a real opportunity to shift the way we relate to each other.
I want to pick up on that, but I have a question for you, Amy Ibbinson. And I mentioned in my introduction, I may think for some, and I'm thinking about families with children. I think the last year has been, you know, just unbelievably difficult managing work and homework and day work for the children in school. And I think for a lot of those families, the idea of the kids back in school and perhaps going back to work seems like a wonderful thing. I think others, you know, this really was a solution to some of the problems that they felt about work. And I think for some others, they goofed off. And as managers, what was it like, do you think, for a lot of managers trying to sort of keep tabs on everybody during the pandemic when people were so scattered?
It's just such a thorny problem. And, you know, we're all human, and human beings will try to optimize their situation. And if you're sitting in, let's just say, a long, maybe tedious meeting for which your input is required only a fraction of the time, if you're not also trying to get something else done at the same time, you're probably not human. In other words, people are on their email. People may be on social media or doing other things at the same time. It's not the same quality of attention. Now, we can solve some of these problems by being more disciplined and deliberate about the length of meetings and the composition of meetings. But we haven't I haven't seen a lot of evidence that we've done that well. So we tend to have hour-long meetings, and they end, and then another one begins. And the quality of attention, the quality of work, the quality of follow-through can easily suffer.
I wonder to you, Connie, about returning to work. And I think for a lot of families, and Amy just mentioned this, you can work from home, you can throw in a load of the laundry, you could take the dog for a quick walk around the block. I mean, those have been a kind of conveniences of working remotely.
Oh, I agree. I mean, and look at the emptying of shelters with the number of people who've gotten pets. So I know those pets are getting some attention during the day as well in this work from home environment. But I wanted to just pick up on your point about people goofing off. Mm-hmm. You know, I teach in the professional evening program at Questrom, and so all my students are working full time. And I have not heard of a single person indicating any level of goofing off. In fact, I think people are working harder than ever, and burnout has been raised over the course of the pandemic. But that said, I do know that managers are afraid of people goofing off. There's been a real concern about losing the line of sight to what workers are doing during the day. And what's happened on the managerial side is that people are now spending so much of their time trying to figure out how to manage that, which means they're having more meetings, they're having more check-ins. I talked to a manager of a consulting firm who was saying that, you know, I now spend so much of my time not doing the work, but just trying to figure out what's happening with the work. And so I think it's unclear to me whether all that was necessary, given what I'm hearing from the people who are actually the ones executing more of the day-to-day work. But nonetheless, I think there has been a tension all along on trying to keep track of who's doing what, whether they're being productive.
Well, and just a follow-up to that, you talk about that so many people working under the pandemic are really burned out. Is that because, you know, that all-elusive work-life balance was really completely obliterated because of the pandemic, Connie?
I think that, I have someone I was talking with in the financial industry who has been busier than ever. I mean, if you talk to anyone in the financial world, you know that's been the case with the way the economy has surprisingly boomed during the pandemic. And he said, you know, I have never had a more productive year, but I've lost all the joy in my work. And so I think that's the 1-2 punch that creates that burnout, which is when you are working incredibly hard. And yes, people have blurred those boundaries and they're working longer hours, more in the evening, more on the weekends. but they're also missing the kind of replenishment and restoration that emotionally sustains you even during those long stretches of hard work.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That is Constance Hadley. She's an organizational psychologist at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. Also with us, Amy Edmondson. She's Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School. Her most recent book is called The Fearless Organization, Creating Psychological Safety in the Workplace for Learning, Innovation, and Growth. And we are talking about the fact that more and more workplaces are thinking about returning some of their remote workers to the workplace on site. And what we have learned in the last year from the pandemic has raised a whole host of questions about what work is, how we do it, the kind of relationships that we have in the workplace. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Amy, let me go back to you. And let's say, you know, companies and more companies are thinking about how they want to bring people back to work. What should they be thinking about? And there is this sort of question about safety, of course, but also treating people individually, but also having equity and fairness when it comes to people's job responsibilities and whether they're doing it at work or at home.
I think it's really important that we start with what is the work and recognize that different kinds of work are going to have different requirements for proximity. And so conceptually, it's simple. You know, working from home is absolutely fine for very independent tasks. And we're making do with video conferencing for the more interdependent. But it's not ideal, as everyone who has experienced it knows. But when the work is codified and can be easily measured and output can be easily measured, no problem. You know, individual codified. When it's more interdependent, more reliant on unscripted coordination, on those happenstance conversations and interactions or short interactions that really enhance the quality of the work, then proximity really helps. So start with the mission, right? Start with what's the purpose of this organization? What value do we deliver to our customers and how do we deliver it? And then back up from there. And it's a design problem. How do we design the next few months so that it works and it has equity and fairness? Mm-hmm. This is, as I said before, thorny issues. This will not be easy to sort out, and it will no doubt take iteration. Like, we'll say, well, let's try this. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of weeks, we'll realize we need to tweak it to make it work. But one thing is for sure, if we just sort of let it happen and you come to work if you feel like it and you don't if you don't, that's probably not going to be optimal for anyone.
Connie, can you talk to this fairness equity issue, which seems so critical?
Yes. So I think there was the example with Professor Field about segregation physically of the office between people who are vaccinated and unvaccinated. I think we have to be really careful to think, too, about segregation across work modes. So who is remote, who is in person, who is hybrid? And as Amy was saying, it's impossible to attend to too many inputs at once, and there will be some collateral damage if we are asking people, as a manager, for example, to manage people across so many different modes. More likely, they will start to favor the people who are right in front of them. If the manager's in the office and they see that person more often, they'll probably start to instinctively think about them for the next project assignment or to spend that unstructured time that may be beneficial to their career in terms of giving advice and mentorship. So I think there is a potential that we can either create or reinforce existing underlying biases from doing that. So, for example, I know a company that's already looking to downsize their real estate as they return to the office, and they've decided that the IT department doesn't need to come. Huh. They are going to get rid of the office space dedicated to IT. So now think about what that means if you're an IT professional working in this organization. You've essentially been told you're not important enough to be able to come into the physical space that they have dedicated to other employees. Now, they may, on the surface, prefer that and even ask for that, but long term, there will be some sort of cracks that develop In terms of those functions relative to the other functions.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let me read some comments, and then, Amy, I'll give you a chance to respond to what Connie just said. Chris from Newtown Square said, now that I've been working from home for over a year, I really don't want to go back to work in my office. I don't miss, and then he has the list here, commuting, packing my lunch, using shared restrooms, and having to spend money on a work wardrobe. I do miss my colleagues, but I would rather stay home. I found that I'm just as productive, if not more so, without the constant interruptions that can happen at work. Here's a comment from Robin. There's no way I want to return to the office 5 days a week, one day at the most, only as needed. It's the flexibility, even more than saving 2 hours of commuting each day. My work is usually not collaborative, so I don't need to be in the office at all the time. And that's from Robin. Amy, if you want to just sort of respond to what Constance was saying, or Connie was saying, about the fact that when there is FaceTime, then you might get more attention from your manager than if people are remote.
She's right. And keep in mind, this is not conscious, right? This isn't something that managers are saying, aha, here's the local person. They're better. They're a better performer. It's just unconsciously we will favor those who are present without intending to. So there are risks. Now, all risks can be managed carefully with deliberate thought and design and processes in place. But we shouldn't underestimate these challenges. And in response to the callers, I think it's so dependent on what work they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Those, I completely appreciate and believe the statements that I'm much more productive at home, I'm happier at home, more power to you. Absolutely fantastic. And if your organization agrees, I think that's a win-win for everybody. We just have to be very thoughtful about the kind of work and what our organizations and what our colleagues need from us and what we need from them and where we feel more happy, more fulfilled, more productive, and where that is borne out by data.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about lessons learned about work from the pandemic, where many people were, frankly, forced to work from home. What are the lessons learned and how do we apply them as we go forward and more people are coming back to work? That is Amy Edmondson. She's a Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School. Wrote a book called The Fearless Organization. Constance Hadley is an organizational psychologist at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. And again, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Do you want to go back to work? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about what we've learned in the last year about working remotely under the pandemic, and will what we have learned change that all-elusive work-life balance and the employer-employee relationship and even the nature of work itself? I want to get back, Connie, to something you said about loneliness, even before the pandemic, loneliness on the job. How pervasive do you think that is? Do we see this in certain kinds of jobs or certain kinds of workplaces or certain kinds of people?
First of all, it is very pervasive. In my research, I studied mostly managers and senior leaders of professional organizations, but Cigna has a terrific series of 10, they have 10,000 people across the country, and they've been studying loneliness, and they've seen that it's been increasing over time. The last data collection was right before the pandemic, to the point where 8 in 10 Generation Z employees were reporting loneliness, and 5 in 10 boomers were. So this is a big problem. Our current Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, has an article that came out a few years ago calling it an epidemic of workplace loneliness.
Wow.
So again, this is just an important point for people to recognize that just magically opening the doors and welcoming people back to your office will not create a deeper sense of integration and engagement and satisfaction just automatically. Things need to be designed differently.
Well, let me pick up on that. That's a serious problem. So how do we redesign it so that people feel less lonely, perhaps, you know, less isolated, less, you know, less unheard, if I can put it that way?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, companies need to start shining a spotlight on this themselves. So trying to understand what is going on with their employees. And again, this is a perfect time for that data collection because people are thinking about how they want to come back to the workplace. So understanding, did their loneliness increase or decrease? Overall, people would obviously say from being separated from each other and quarantine that the loneliness has increased, but it may not be the particular case in your organization and with your employees. And so that's one thing, is to start measuring it. But the other thing is to think about how the work is designed. So one of the things that contributes to that sense of superficial connection is a really intense, fast-paced work environment and teams that are shifting frequently, where members kind of jump in and out, where teams are agile and they start and stop quickly. You know, people just can't develop the closeness to each other. There isn't time, and then there's also a shifting membership. So that's one thing. Maybe think about slowing down teams, creating more like home teams, teams that are more permanent and reinforced over time. But also thinking about, are there ways to change the types of conversations that happen at work? So I know of a couple companies that are doing experiments with empathy workshops, for example, where they get employees together, and this can be over Zoom or in person, and they start opening up new conversation threads that are intended to get below the surface. And that requires a real commitment on the organization because they're taking people away from what they might consider the productive hours of the day to have those conversations with each other. But I do believe that in the long term, it will be worth it because employees who are lonely not only do less strong work, they're more likely to leave. And also they may incur lots of healthcare costs because there's so many physical maladies that go along with loneliness. And one report is equated it to smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
So, you know, thinking about it from an economic standpoint is another, you know, point I want companies to think about. It's in their best interest. It's not just to make employees feel better emotionally. It's actually to make them, you know, work better and live longer and be more productive.
Amy, let me ask you a more sort of global question about the nature of work and whether we have now this opportunity after it's not like the pandemic is over, but sort of the worst of the pandemic, at least in 2020, seems to be over. Whether it's time to rethink what work is, and is it about being on the clock? Is it about being in your scene? Is it about the work product, whatever that is? How do you see that?
Absolutely. This is an opportunity for global rethinking about what work is, what it means. For example, I think before the pandemic, many, many organizations had drifted into a pattern of overwork, of face time. You know, if you're present in the office until 8 p.m., all the better, or 9 p.m., or whatever it is, depending on the industry. When even just a generation ago, we might look askance at someone who's still at his desk, likely at his, after six, because the implication was you can't get your work done in reasonable time. So those norms shifted way off, partly with the 24/7 always on culture that was with us even before the pandemic. This interruption is a real opportunity to rethink work, to stop equating work hours with productivity. I mean, it's very hard to measure productivity in knowledge work, but I think we make this mistake all the time of thinking just because you put in X hours, that meant you were productive. Like, how do we assess the quality? How do we assess the output? Really challenging in many industries. But this is an opportunity to rethink what would make work more humane, you know, more valuable for the organizations and for the employees.
It is. I don't need to tell you, Amy Edmondson, it's hard to change culture, right? A culture at work.
It is, but companies do it all the time when they recognize the opportunity, right? When they recognize that by investing in culture change, they will be better off. Employees will be better off. Customers will be better off. That they recognize that the culture they have is getting in the way of the mission they have. Right? So then they say, okay, what does it need to look? And this is a team problem, if you will. No one changes the culture in a top-down command and control manner. It's an invitation to take a look at who we are and how we do things and how we might do them better. And that becomes a very local question. Right? If you're working in order taking, that's a different job than if you're working in the factory producing goods, if you're working in the supply chain, if you're working in product development, all of those tasks are so very different. And helping to recreate how to do them in a more humane and energizing way is a joint problem-solving opportunity.
Let me read a comment from Warren. He says, my opinion of remote working is that it is nowhere near as efficient. People don't answer emails promptly. They never talk to you on the phone. Trying to get an answer to something that would normally take a few minutes can take days and days. We need to get people in offices, eyeballs in front of eyeballs, to make things happen properly. That's Warren. Connie, what do you say back to Warren?
Well, I would really be curious to know what kind of work Warren does and who he's communicating with, because, again, I actually have experienced the opposite, where people now are responding to emails at 11 o'clock at night because there's just people always have their computer open or their phone next to them. But that being said, what he might be experiencing is not so much this concern that people are not doing their work, they're not being productive, but that they are overwhelmed with the demands that are in front of them. And that may be from work, but it also may be what's happening at home as well. So we also have to recognize that there are many, many people who are caregiving during this pandemic, children who are homeschooled or parents who, there's health concerns that they're taking care of. And so I don't know how much of that would exist, say, post-vaccination, post-return to full open school systems in the fall. There may be a natural increase in productivity for those people affected in those ways.
Here's a comment from John. I've been working remotely since March 2020 and will refuse to go back to the office if my company makes that move. Work from home allows me to cook every meal, exercise during the day, take numerous small breaks to read, play music, etc. The office would feel wildly oppressive now, and the draconian idea of having to wait until 5 o'clock to leave despite the work being done is a nightmare. He goes on from there. Amy, but it seems that a number of companies are thinking of a sort of a hybrid way, which is maybe not 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, but perhaps there's another way to rethink work that allows for some flexibility.
Yes, a number of companies, I would say probably most companies are thinking very hard right now about hybrid possibilities. And what will that look like? Will it be that we come in on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? Will it be that, different teams pick their own days? It's going to have to be, thought through very carefully with an eye on what is it we do and how do we do it well together. And what does that imply for the coordination needs? So, my heart goes out to these folks who say, wow, I'm loving this. Yeah. This works for me. I don't want to go back. My employer wants me to go back. And I'm struck by, to a comment, they never say what they do. And so it's so hard to judge whether and when that's, a perfectly reasonable stance based on so little knowledge.
Sure.
I think, to state an extreme case, if you are taking care of patients in the hospital, we need you there for the most part. Right? There are very few clinical jobs that can be done remotely. There are some, thankfully. But it's going to have to be very customized, very careful, and very iterative.
And Amy, just a quick follow-up. How much choice do you think an employee has, which is say, look, You know, I can do this from home. Trust me. Does that work?
It depends. I mean, I think trust me is a nice start, and demonstrate is the next step. Right. So if a job can be done as well from home and the person wants to be at home, absolutely. Why not? Right. You'd be crazy to suggest otherwise. However, for many jobs that's not the case, and for some jobs, unfortunately, it's hard to tell.
Here's a comment from Chris. It's slightly a more macro perspective, and Connie, I'll put this to you. Chris says, how much will of the workforce working from home negatively affect other businesses, for instance, not buying clothes or picking up a cup of coffee? I think it's good to be rethinking all the junk we buy, et cetera, but I want other businesses to keep going. And it is true, Connie, that there's so many people who rely on us, frankly, going to work so that they can sell us that cup of coffee.
Right, absolutely. I mean, you see the decimation of downtown office areas in terms of not only the brick and mortar restaurants and shops that existed, but think about all the people who made their living on street carts and other, you know, more mobile ways of providing services. It's very difficult to think about how those people will survive if the work continues to mostly be remote. I think, though, that what this does is just go back again to one of the themes that Amy made, which is about interdependence. Everyone is inclined to think about what's best for them individually, but you really have to be conscious of the degree to which you depend on others and others depend on you, and that's within your team. Start there. It's thinking about your external stakeholders, like your clients and customers, but it really also might involve the greater ecosystem that you are there to support. You know, are you a company whose part of their mission is to invest back in the community? If that's true, then that might be another argument for trying to bring people back to the workplace. But I also want to just emphasize this notion about iteration, or in my mind, I'm really trying to think about it like experimentation. I really think that companies should not make a long-term plan right now about what the return to the office should look like for them. I think it's very important to think about, maybe based on what the workflow is or the financial calendar that they operate under, but 3 to 6 months ahead, you know, this is what we'll try. Because we have to be careful about people holding on to what their employer says now and reacting to it as if it's permanent, good or bad. You know, there are companies who are pulling their employees back sooner than they had first projected. People are not happy about that.
No, they're not.
Because they were told they wouldn't have to come back until after Labor Day. And it feels like a real betrayal. And there will be a lot of negative effects from that sentiment of employees. So I think stop talking about like long-term decrees. Think about like what can you do for the next, you know, fall? What are you going to do for fall? And then how are you going to be measuring the success or failure of your experiment? So people also need to understand, what are the metrics? So we've talked a lot about productivity and work-life balance. Those are two important ones, but there are other aspects as well, like innovation, or even thinking about employee, you know, well-being and health. And so I think that if we shift from we're making a decision for the long term to all we're presenting are hypotheses that we're going to test, I think it will allay some of the angst that's involved on both sides, the decision makers and the recipients, whatever those decisions are.
Amy, I'm going to squeeze in a quick question before we have to end our show. But how important is it for then employers to be very transparent, to share information? I mean, just to make sure that we're all on the same page.
I'm for as transparent as humanly possible. Say what you're thinking, say what you know, say what you don't yet know. And as Connie put it, experimentation is job one right now. We were all forced to go through a major experiment over a year ago. Now it's time to design experiments, do them thoughtfully, test them carefully, and learn as we go, absolutely transparently.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times, helping us think through this moment that we're in. Amy Edmondson, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
You're very welcome.
And she's Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School. Her most recent book is called The Fearless Organization. Connie Hadley, thank you so much for joining us as well.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Constance Hadley, organizational psychologist at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. And we began our conversation with Drexel University's Robert Field. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.